G'day humans, welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. This is an end of 2025, beginning of 2026 retrospective on some of our highlights and lowlights of the year with the one and only Evan Pavanka. You know him, you love him. Community manager of Uncomfortable Conversations, works tirelessly around the clock.
You know,
and the work mostly entails taking kids to Little League.
Swim season now, actually. But
swim season? Isn't it cold? Isn't it cold as
they're winter swimmers, indoor swim meets. Don't get your kids into swim, whatever you do. It's
you're talking to an Australian. We are getting our kids into swimming. But and like, today is about 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, well then, yeah, I mean, swim for fun,
yeah.
But don't competitively swim.
Why not?
The meets are a grind. They're like 6 hours, and then you swim for, you watch your kids swim for 45 seconds, and then you wait. It's just a fiasco. Swim parents are way too passionate about it, and it's not my favorite. But I love my kids more than anything, and I will do whatever they're into, you know.
I like that you felt the need to add that caveat in case they ever listen to this in 20 years' time. When they go, why did daddy not like us?
Because
he didn't like swimming.
No.
Okay, so we were just saying that you're wearing your hat backwards, which is fabulous to see.
Thanks.
So you don't cover your eyes, but you still get to hide your terrible haircut.
Yeah. I haven't had my hair cut for years, Josh.
No.
So it's just, I was at the gym earlier, so it's just a little flat on the top.
You don't have to flex. You don't have to flex with me.
It's okay. You know.
I know you go to the gym. I mean, you don't get a body like that without working out.
Is there a gym that way? Maybe. Or speaking of aesthetics, I was sad to see your beard has gone. I thought you looked so even handsomer
than usual.
Thank
you very much. Well, I did grow a beard. I didn't grow a beard. What I did was I was just lazy, and I went to the United Kingdom, and then there was lots of travel, and then I went out to the outback in Australia, and I took the kids to a big zoo out there. And then by the time I got back, I realized, oh, I look like a wolf man. I look like an unkempt wolf man. I look almost as deranged as Evan.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, I got to bring it up a little. So I got a haircut and I trimmed my facial hair.
Well, now we're properly yin and yanging, you know, for the Substack community. It'd be weird if we both were rugged, handsome.
That's right.
Know,
one of us has to look, one of us has to look civilized. So, Evan, when you gaze back on this this year, what stands out to you as some of the episodes or the trajectory of the show that is worth noting for the loyal listener?
Well, you know, I think there were a few blockbuster episodes, obviously. I re-listened to the Sam Harris episode again. And, you know, I'm assuming many of the people here now are kind of your diehard regulars and have heard everything anyway. But, you know, I thought that conversation, first of all, I loved the length. And I think, I know you're a busy guy, and I would love to hear from the community what they think. But I often am feeling, you know, hungry for more when the shorter episodes end. And the way that you guys were able, I think it went like 2.5 hours maybe with Sam.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's always time for Sam. I'll always, go for 4 hours with Sam.
For sure. So that was, you know, I think if I had to come up with like a top episode, I think that was my favorite. And Sam's obviously I'm a big fan of his work anyway.
But
I think,
That was cool.
It was very cool. But I think what I like anyway, and I don't want to speak for everybody, you know, the episodes where you get personal, I think, are always better. You know, the one that stands out on that front was, I'm forgetting the woman's name, but the sort of like natural parenting, male-female families are better.
Katie
conversation.
Faust. Yeah, the anti-surrogacy campaigner.
You know, I think as intelligent and well-spoken and well-read as you are, I think many of our listeners, you know, love you as a person as well, or want to get to know you more. And hearing you talk about your family, and anytime you sort of, the conversation navigates into more personal space, I always get a lot out of that. I mean, I know you well-ish and you know, like you, outside of your big brain. But I think giving that to the readers and the listeners is always
a big bonus. You want me to do an OnlyFans, basically. You want me to do an OnlyFans and have an additional paid tier where I furiously masturbate in front of the audience.
Yeah,
that's fine. And
now I can definitely show this to my kids. They'll appreciate it. So that's good.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I also think the Katie Faust episode, which if people haven't heard, was called Josh versus the Anti-Gay Parenting Activist.
Yeah.
Was maybe certainly one of my favorites. I didn't think because it was personal. I just thought because it was a good example of trying to model how to people who would ordinarily in the conventional wider culture be expected to demonize each other and accuse each other of wanting to erase one's identity and being a fascist or whatever.
Exactly.
We're able to actually try to unpick what the source of the disagreement and if there's any common ground on values. So I thought it was, and I thought she was really smart and a good sport to do it as well. Because it's not like I don't want to do more episodes where a very thoughtful person who I massively disagree with comes and argues with me. But there are not a lot of them. Like there are a lot of people who are very, very conservative or very, very social justice-y are either ideologues or cowards.
Yeah.
And they're not that. So they're either not going to be up to the they're not going to be an interesting conversation because they're just going to parrot talking points, or they're not going to be willing to have the conversation. So kudos to Katie for doing it.
Big time. And, you know, I think that, again, as we talk about where you want this Substack to go, you know, if you could wave your magic wand and turn it into whatever you want, I continue to come back to what you uniquely bring to your audience, I think, is more style than substance. I mean, again, I appreciate all of your opinions and takes, and I think you're just an incredible articulator of, you know, the kinds of social ideas that are floating around. You do a fantastic job, but it's the method itself, the way that you talk, the way that you engage with your guests, that I think that's why people keep coming back to you. I mean, I can go to BBC or whatever and read the news, but hearing you engage and modeling for us how to have a civil discourse with somebody you disagree with, that's your bread and butter, and that's what makes you so special. One of the many things that makes you so special. So,
okay, well, we can draw a line under the flattery now, and I think we've had enough of it for this conversation. So that's
so
I'll
funny.
Take that as a given.
Hop on my couch, Josh, and let's unpack why every time.
Only because it's boring for listeners. I mean,
I think
the Sam Harris one, for people who don't know, that was part of a Zeps Live world tour where we went around the world, literally around the world, in one continuous direction, stopping in a bunch of different exotic locales and interviewing, doing live stream podcasts with Sam and Tyler Cowen and Rich Roll and Sarah Hayter and
Nick Cave,
Jimmy Carr.
Also,
yeah, Nick
top
was
five.
One of my yes, and Jimmy. I mean, Jimmy is always fascinating, and Nick was fascinating in an unusual or unexpected way. I thought, like, Nick was really contemplative and
very
spiritual
thoughtful.
And philosophical.
Well, I didn't realize his work on grief and all of that. I mean, I knew him from his music, obviously, but you know, those kind of multidimensional people, I think, are so fascinating. And when you're able to, well, sorry, I was about to compliment you again.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you nipping that in the bud.
I'm gonna have to rewrite my whole script.
Andrew Sullivan, we had on the show earlier in the year, and that was excellent. Also, because I was going to do a live stream with Andrew Sullivan from Provincetown while I was on the world tour, but my dad had just died. So when I got to Provincetown, Andrew was like, oh, fuck that. Let's not do it. Let's just get stoned and watch South Park. And so
Perfect. We
did that and, then rode his bikes up to the sand dunes. And
that was spectacular.
Just hung out, which was heaps better than doing a podcast. So apologies to the fans, but that was my favorite non-episode of the year, or the episode that could have been that didn't come to be. But you can go back and listen to the original Andrew Sullivan chat if you wish to. Also honorable mentions, Will Anderson, the Australian comic, as well as Jimmy Carr, as well as Nick Cave. And I thought that Tim Minchin was this year as well, but apparently it was last year.
That was the end of last year.
Yeah, that was 2024. But those guys also, I think, are just, I love having conversations with creatives who wrestle with massive questions about what it means to be alive and what the purpose of the cosmos is and what human communication is all about. Sometimes they're the wisest people.
I think so. And again, the meta layer of why comedy right now is so necessary to kind of keep us all sane, and remember that it's good to laugh with other people in a room. You know, those kinds of themes, I think, were refreshing always to hear you talk about. And then was the Candace Owens this year?
Oh, yeah. Was Candace this year?
Yeah.
Apparently, no. Just
at the end?
Snuck into last year.
Shucks.
Nonetheless, but we can talk about her.
Well, I just, again, I think that, you know, your ability to sit down, I'm trying to like say this without blowing it up your ass. First of all, you looked terrible in that episode.
Thank you.
I will say,
Thank you.
Just looked like garbage.
Good.
But no,
I like this
again,
better.
The idea of like, platforming and all of that stuff. I think you've done a really nice job of navigating those waters and bringing on guests, treating them fairly, but also, you know, being willing to expose some ideas you don't agree with. And I thought that was a good
example.
I do
think it's important when you're platforming is such a silly idea because you're talking about one of the most popular podcasters in the world in Candace Owens coming on my show. It's not like, I mean,
yeah, no one.
Some
had heard
people
of her.
Said, "Yeah, exactly. That's right." Some people said, "Well, you know, there would be plenty of Australians who listen to you who don't really, who aren't really aware of her. They might have heard her name, but now you're allowing her to present her case to them, and they might subscribe to her podcast." But I do think that as long as you do the job of actually sort of trying to reveal them to be what they are and giving them just enough rope that they can hang themselves with it, then it's not a bad thing to talk to anyone. It is a shame that there's still this sort of cultural meme that you're defined by the people you talk to. Like, you can imagine someone trying to dismiss me by saying like, "Oh, so says the guy who platforms Candace Owens and
Evan Pavanka
and
God's
Evan."
Sake.
Exactly. Look at his hair.
Untrustworthily long.
And it wouldn't matter what you said on the podcast that, you know, you would get lumped into the same category as Tucker Carlson nodding along to Nick Fuentes.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of Tucker, I think your Just Josh has continued to be pretty universally great.
These are the solo editorials that I do, which we call Just Josh.
Yeah. And your take on Tucker was solid. You know, I think one of the most common sort of, not complaints, but some of the feedback we get in the Substack comments is often about the back and forth and you, like, some people want to hear more of you and less of the guest. Some people want to hear less of the guest and, or more of the guest, you know what I meant? And I think the Just Josh is nice to sprinkle in there because I think there's a good part of your audience that just loves to hear you think through things and read what you've written. I think I've always told you, damn it, I'm just going to leave. I can't do it without complimenting you. People don't, if you're not familiar, Josh is an excellent writer. And that's one of my goals is to keep pushing you to write more for the Substack. Because I think people still do enjoy reading kind of long-ish form stuff. I know it takes a lot more time and you're so good at just winging it when you get on and stuff, but you're an excellent writer.
Well, I mean, writing is just time consuming in comparison to producing content. I mean, video content. And I'm also just better at wrestling with thoughts and articulating myself and going on parenthetical loops
sure.
that in writing would seem unfocused. Yeah. So it's purely a time thing.
How do you feel? I mean, looking back on the year, you're what, 2 years now from when you left, a little over 2 years from when you
struck out on your own? Yeah, right on 2 years.
I remember being in Copenhagen listening to your talk with Barry Weiss. So I guess that was a little over two years ago when you kind of talked about striking out. And I mean, how do you feel the year went? Are you happy with?
Yeah, great. I mean, it's been a challenging year in a bunch of ways. My dad died. You know, we moved house. There's all these like personal kind of logistical things, but it's been great. I've got a great new producer who came on at the beginning of the year, Jono.
Jono! The best.
Now got a kind of a supervising producer working one day a week, Jono, who's also great. We've got a new business manager, Ben. So I feel like at the beginning of the year, I was a little bit like a lost duckling who didn't quite know how to hold the whole thing together. But I feel like we've got the support now. And of course, you're tireless around the work, around the clock commitment. Evan,
you know,
which is invaluable.
I mean, how can we make the Substack better for you?
I think that one of the things that we've been experimenting with is leaning more into live stuff as well as the bread and butter Uncomfortable Conversations episodes. So, you know, towards the end of the year, we started experimenting with this idea called Josh versus the News, where once a week I would just sort of do a live stream, which we would release on the podcast as well, where I would analyze some of the stories that maybe the news either wasn't covering or was covering suboptimally, and take questions and comments from the Substack community as well. And so there will continue to be more bonus episodes and more benefits for especially the paid subscriber tier throughout 2026, we won't always notify the free subscribers or the podcast listeners about those. But I think people will just see more live video content popping up if they want to consume it, because I do want it to start feeling more interactive. I think it's a strength of mine to be able to, just from my training of hosting a public radio show with a lot of talkback for 3 hours a day for years, means that I'm not bad at speaking extemporaneously and juggling incoming comments and questions and things like that. So I think creating this space as a forum where people can feel like they're drinking from a cool stream in a, you know, maddening, fiery cacophony of the rest of the media, where they can come for a space of sanity and some of the more important stories from an angle that they know will be free of bullshit is my goal. And I'm looking forward to 2026 because I think all of the dominoes are in place to keep expanding that mission.
Yeah. I would just for the subscribers and listeners, you know, just really encourage people to get comfortable commenting and posting their thoughts in the Substack thread below the episodes. I mean, there have been some great conversations. A few times it's gone a little off the rails depending on the topic. But I think compared to other message, I mean, go on Sam Harris's comments. I think our audience is incredibly intelligent and thoughtful with their comments, and it can really become an excellent space to you know, expand on the things that you've covered and bring different perspectives. I think the very cool thing about your Substack is, you know, you have the Australian perspective, you have kind of Australian specific topics and guests every once in a while. And I think a big part of your audience is Australian, but then also the international perspective. It's a very cool place. And I really enjoy hearing from,
I would love to hear
from more people.
Yes. You know? I think if anyone is ever tempted to dip their toe in, then please do. Cause I love seeing occasionally actual conversations, take place, you know, not just about the episode, but between members of the audience as well, because it makes me feel like we're all pulling in the same direction and we're all on the, you know, we're all part of a community. We have tried, just on a content question when you mentioned Australia, to do less Australian stuff. The audience in Australia grew quite a lot when I left the ABC. And since then, with stuff like the World Tour in the States, the American audience has grown even more strongly. So we still have, the United States is still our number one market, followed by Australia, and the two of them are maybe 80% of listeners, and then the rest is the UK and other places. So strategically, we've tried to do less. Like when we do Australian stuff, I want it to be Australian stuff that resonates with people everywhere because it's about global issues. I don't want to ever do something that's about like a local horse race. Very, 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 very rarely, you know.
Right. Having the former prime minister on, I thought that episode was great. And for somebody who had no idea who he was or what he was talking about, it was very accessible and I thought really an interesting conversation, especially about immigration. I mean, there are certain themes that kind of keep popping up. Obviously, part of that's just because that's what's in the zeitgeist right now. But I would encourage listeners to check that out.
Yes, Tony Abbott. He was on a few weeks ago, and he was one of the architects of Australia's very harsh policy towards asylum seekers, which is now being looked at closely and potentially replicated by other Western countries who are dealing with dysfunction at their own borders. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. And I mean, yes, it's a conscious choice that I make to focus on issues like that I know are relevant everywhere rather than talking to Australian leaders about saving koalas,
right,
which is not going to have the same applicability for an American audience. I mean, the other creative content choice that people may not have consciously noticed that we've made this year is to not focus on Trump very much at all. We haven't spent a lot of time following the ins and outs of the Trump administration. I think other outlets do that enough that you don't really need my predictable banging away about, unless we're talking in big, broad brushstrokes about autocracy or how authoritarianism functions or challenges to democracy or something.
Yeah.
We've tried explicitly not to be jumping at every news cycle from the American administration, which I think would have risked becoming tiresome.
Very. And as a listener, I appreciate not being hit over the head with the same bad, takes over and over again. So thank you for that. Kudos. What do you see on the horizon topic-wise? Like, what do you think we're going to be talking about for the next year? AI continues to be kind of top of mind.
What
keeps you up at night these days?
Well, I mean, in recent weeks, obviously, the tragedy in Bondi Beach is front of mind. And so the capacity of liberal democracies to pull off the multicultural experiment without resorting to either far-right xenophobic politics or just sort of finding themselves consumed by internecine tribal warfare between jihadists and other extremists is front of mind for me. But I hope that doesn't become anything more than just a background issue throughout 2026. I mean, it's hard to make predictions. Obviously, the second half of 2026 will be heavily focused in the United States on the midterm elections.
Yeah. There's
going to be a lot of political chatter. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a stock market crash at some point in the next 12 months. Everyone who knows anything about economics seems to think everything is massively overvalued, so that'll probably take up some kind of oxygen. But it's probably unlikely to hopefully be too bad or too like the ripple effects shouldn't be like what they were during the financial crisis, because it doesn't seem like banks are over leveraged the same way that they were. So it'll just be a bunch of people losing money and maybe a recession.
Yeah.
What else? It'll just be interesting, I think, to watch the decline of the Trump administration. I think he's on the precipice of the beginning of the end of his influence and popularity. So the Republican Party will be shuffling around and trying to think what's next and who is next, which is kind of crazy since we're only a year into the administration and you're already in American politics thinking about what's going to happen in 3 years' time. But as always, what we'll probably be talking about is the things that we don't know that we don't know. It's always the unknown unknowns that get us.
The known unknowns and the known... Was that Rumsfeld?
It was Rumsfeld. There are known knowns and there are known unknowns.
I mean, he's not wrong.
He was totally right. I thought he was. I mean, we learned that in like first year logic and philosophy at university. So he's, and everyone was ridiculing him as if he was an idiot. But it is a good point to make that, you know, there are things that you know that you don't know. Like, I know that I don't know how to speak Russian, but there are all kinds of things that I'm not even aware that I don't know.
Right.
which I can't articulate because I don't know that I don't know them.
It's good.
Shall we just go through? I just want to remind ourselves and the listener, unless you wanted to jump in there with a
I hope we do get to chat first, or we don't have to chat, but just to recognize the episode. And I don't have the name in front of me, but where he just like didn't respond to anything you said for an hour. remind me who that was.
Who was that? It was a fellow Substacker.
Yeah.
Right?
And kind of a popular one who I had read, and he just, I can see him. I can see his face.
Jono, the producer, is coming. Oh, yeah. Noah Smith from No Opinion.
Yeah.
Is that who you're thinking of? Yeah, yes. Yeah. Lovely guy. Lovely guy. And we also just were just like talking in parallel for quite some time.
That was a surreal experience and made me feel great about myself. I was like, well, I can't be the worst guest he has on now.
You're like, I may have a backwards hat and long, lanky hair, but I at least can put a couple of words together that are relevant to what Josh is saying.
I think so. Yeah, I hope
so. But speaking of the difference between writing and speaking, I mean, his blog is so good. He is an incredible writer, a fantastic thinker. And I think sometimes guests just come in and are not quite sure what this show is or who I am or why they've been invited on. And so they try to follow my lead. And sometimes I do a good job of modeling that lead. And sometimes I do a less good job because I kind of actually just like the awkwardness of... occasionally enjoy bombing as well,
poking. It started. Something came up about like pet rabbits or something, right? And then he was like, "No, I have pet rabbits." And you were like, "Oh, okay, interesting."
Yes.
And then he was like offended by that, I think.
I was talking about myxomatosis in Australia, or feral pests, and this was way off the reservation.
He had those AI images of like rabbits fighting on tanks and stuff. I mean,
yes,
it was,
and kangaroos and things. It was
wild.
All over the place. Yes.
Yeah.
So I was just going to go over and review some of the month by month of this year to hold people's hand and take them through what was going on this year. The year opened with the LA fires. Can you believe that's a year ago?
Wow.
So I did a monologue on the 10th of January about the about LA being on fire, we were talking about Gaza and Trump and Israel and Palestine at that period as well. In February, we talked about there was a good one which was actually paywalled, which was about fentanyl. I don't know if you ever heard that one, but it was with a journalist who was writing a book about the Chinese trade in fentanyl and how fentanyl is produced. And he actually went undercover in China as a reporter and sort of risked his life, like, liaising with the Chinese mafia and going to fentanyl labs and stuff. I thought that was really interesting as well.
I was just going to say all the Venezuela stuff and the crackdown on cocaine, not a cocaine user myself, but but I understand that some people do enjoy it. And, I heard a statistic, the number of man hours it takes to process like a gram of cocaine versus fentanyl. Mm. It's like a tenth of a thousandth. I mean, it's nothing. And so one unfortunate thing is when you limit the supply of cocaine, you're going to open the door for more and more fentanyl users.
I heard that too. It was amazing, wasn't it? I think it was the historian who was on Sam's show who was talking about
drugs. I think that's where I heard it.
And I think he was saying that a dose of, or it may be a baggie or whatever, but I think he was saying like one dose of cocaine takes something like 4 months worth of manpower to produce in terms of the growing and everything. And one dose of fentanyl is 4 hours.
Yeah,
of manpower. So it's like, an order of magnitude more convenient.
Yeah.
So yes, that was fentanyl. That was in February. There was also an interesting one in January about how religious Americans might be able to defeat Trumpism by redefining a more apolitical vision of conservative Christianity that is more about personal conduct and less about national, fighting for national hegemony. I thought that was interesting. That was called How the Church Can Defeat Trumpism. And then in February, we also interviewed a survivor of October 7th, Natalie Senandaji.
Powerful.
March, we were talking about, there was the Canadian election as well in March. So we had Jen Gerson on, who's excellent Canadian journalist, who was incredibly depressed and sort of traumatized about the Trump trade war with Canada and Canada's need to essentially resituate itself strategically completely and reorient its priorities because so much had changed in its relationship with the US. Then what did we have? That's right. We had one of Jono, my producer's favorites, was with the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Dave Sweeney, about nuclear. He's an anti-nuclear campaigner. That was in March.
Amazing. And I think nuclear power.
I don't really remember. Yeah, I don't remember that being.
It was so especially.
I don't remember much of it.
Layered on to the AI conversation, and the whole abundance thing. The role of nuclear power and, by extension, nuclear arms and whether those two are related.
Because he's he's anti-nuclear power. He's anti-nuclear everything, obviously. He won a Nobel Peace Prize for being anti-nuclear. Right. But I guess maybe I'm biased because I'm in favor of nuclear power as a climate fighting thing. So I just found some of those arguments unpersuasive.
Same.
But maybe that's just me. One of my favorite episodes happened in April, which was with this Finnish education expert, Pasi Stahlberg, who I sat down with in Melbourne. And if people haven't heard that, that's definitely one I would
go back
to. Because he was one of the architects of what became the world's best education system in Finland and has all of these ideas about what it means to be a kid, about thinking about the way that schools are designed and built and run from the perspective of a kid, things that Finland did that we could do here. Just really clever person to wrestle with about what is too much love, what is too much discipline, how do you raise clever kids, well-adjusted kids.
Well, and as we've learned so much in the last 50 years about child psychology and kind of how things work, and yet our early education system really hasn't changed all that much in many ways.
Yeah.
And I think it's just one of the unfortunate consequences of status quo, comfort is that people get very nervous when you start talking about educational reforms and rocking the boat in that department. And yet hearing that conversation, it was so obvious. You hear that stuff and it's of course.
Yes. And we still we teach kids in the same way that we did when during the Industrial Revolution, when we were training them all, to become factory workers.
In many ways.
Sit in a line, shut up, listen to the teacher.
Yeah.
Is that the best way to make them creative in an era of AI?
Well, and I know we've talked about this before too, but the role of technology in education, we struggle with our own kids. I'm making Henry work on his handwriting and then it's this kid's never going to hold a pencil in his life.
Yeah.
Why are we banging on? I feel like an old guy saying, go out in the yard and roll a hoop down the hill with a stick.
Yes.
It's he's got to learn how to navigate technology because that's going to be his future. And yet
rolling
still
a hoop down a hill with a stick is probably more beneficial in more scenarios than writing a handwritten note.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
You may
sometimes
need it.
Balance, coordination. It's harder than you think. I do make them, for an hour a day. We have a big hill outside our house and I do have them roll a hoop down
it.
And it's
Have you seen the viral videos of the car tires bouncing down the side of mountains?
Oh my god. Amazing. Amazing.
There are a lot of them, but the best one is was recommended to me on the Slate Political Gabfest by David Plotz, who has found the supreme YouTuber who all he does is just take these high quality drone videos, and the drone chases the tire down what looks like the Swiss Alps or something. Like, it looks just amazing.
Amazing.
It's just this beautiful scenery, and it goes on and on and on and on, bouncing down the side of a mountain that's like thousands of kilometers high.
So when you like can't sleep at night, what's your go-to? Do you like watch dumb YouTube videos, or do you read a book like a human being?
I rarely can't sleep. If I can't sleep, then I think about airplanes and what which first class cabins I like the best.
Here we go. We've been on for 35 minutes, and that's got to be a record.
I've held out that long.
I'm impressed, my friend.
But if I'm just trying to fill time in the evening, the good version of me will read a book. The bad version of me will watch something on streaming. I really don't use YouTube. I'm like the only person in the world who doesn't just bounce around YouTube. I just don't want to be nudged by algorithms. I'd rather watch Pluribus on Apple TV than, you know, I'm tired going down a hill. That's only when I'm like eating sushi, you know, and waiting in line at the pharmacy or something that I'm watching YouTube.
I got into these, I promise I won't go on too long about this, but these ancient Chinese craftsmanship videos.
I'm already bored.
Where they make, spectacular vases or vases, I guess, or whatever, or like old jewelry and stuff. But it shows the whole process and it's all artisanal. And I thought, oh gosh, this is great. Then I dug into it. They're all created by the Chinese Communist Party. They're all like propaganda videos to push Chinese culture, stuff. I still love them, but I thought it was this incredible artisanal farm out in the Chinese mountains that were producing these, but it's not.
Okay. To be honest, most stuff that comes out of the People's Republic probably has the imprimatur of the Communist Party on it in some way.
Certainly its approval. Yeah,
exactly. They're not doing something that they disapprove of. We've gone through March, April. Then, it was actually May that was Dave Sweeney, the nuclear activist. There was also an interesting one in May with Amos Goldberg, the Israeli genocide historian who wrote the piece Why Gaza is Genocide. This was in May, and that got a lot of criticism, obviously. The following month, I sat down with Einat Wilf, who's an Israeli parliamentarian, to sort of give the opposite case. And I think those two episodes, the Amos Goldberg, which is called Why Gaza is Genocide, and then a month later, it was actually a month to the day, Einat Wilf called The Palestinian Delusion.
And around
were good.
That
yeah.
time you wrote, when did you write your?
Yeah, around that time. That's right. I wrote it between those two. It was because I did the Goldberg interview, and then people freaked out that I was, you know, not exposing myself to enough pro-Israel ideas. And so then we booked Einat, and I wrote this piece that subsequently was probably phrased in a slightly too Joshy manner. In terms of being slightly too pithy and provocative.
I sprinkled that one little line.
Exactly. Yeah. I know. So that was an interesting time of year, because that was also when we were preparing for the world tour. In fact, when we went on the world tour when was that? July? Did we go on the world tour? Yeah, in July. And some funny anecdotes about that you and the audience may not know about. You know, New York City in July, it's warm.
Hot.
Having lived there for a dozen years, I should have known that mid-July in New York can be incredibly unpleasant. Also, Washington, D.C., which is literally built on a swamp. Very, very humid. So we had like one of our first interviews in New York was with Jesse Singel. From Blocked and Reported. And
was that up on the balcony or whatever?
So it was up on the balcony. We decided it would look great if we had the New York skyline behind us, you know, instead of always looking like we're in this kind of generic set. So we set it up on the outside on the balcony in Brooklyn with the New York skyline behind us. And it's like 105 degrees in the shade. And Jesse is just sweating like a madman, and he's got a sunscreen spray of like a sun lotion that he just keeps leaning over and spraying at me into my eyes and all over my body during the during the live stream. So
he was
God
worried
bless
about
that man.
You.
Yeah, he was concerned.
He
was concerned. And then we also did a live show at the Comedy Cellar. Yeah, given what?
I was going to say, given the record of Australian sunscreen, you know, it's...
What? Is there something I don't know about?
I think. Right? Wasn't there a big scandal that they measured the SPF? Jono knows. They measured the SPF of all these sunscreens and they were like
a tenth
of what they were supposed to be. And
I think that was just because SPF is sort of bullshit beyond about 15 anyway. I think like, because it's supposed to be, I think this is true. I was once told by a chemist that like the SPF is supposed to denote the number of times, it's supposed to be an X on the amount of time that it's going to take you to get the same amount of damaging UV. So SPF 5 means that 5 hours will give you the same as 1 hour without it. 15, you'd have to have 15 hours for 1 hour. Once you get past 15 up to like 50 hours or something, well, in that time, it's all going to have wiped off and like you will have, you'll be dead.
You
got to
reapply.
Hours. So it's,
you need a Jesse Single there to be, I'm a big
be
SPF
spraying
for,
me constantly.
For banana right. boat, dark oil kind
just,
of a guy. So.
Oh, wow. Really? Not in Australia, bro. You're going to burn
anymore.
Your ass off with that.
Not
shit.
Anymore. That was before I was a father. And I've you know, things to live for now.
Yeah, but you live in a cold climate anyway, so you're not getting any. You're probably not getting enough UV at this time of year.
It gets pretty hot, and we just came back from the Bahamas, which was lovely.
That's true. Who did you meet in the Bahamas that you sent me a text message about?
Jason Isaacs, the White Lotus guy. He was amazing. Well,
yeah, so he was season 3 of White Lotus, the you know the main,
but also
the guy
Lucius Malfoy.
Finances are falling apart.
Yeah,
and he was the star of this great. Show that only lasted one season, and I don't remember what it was. Oh, it was called Awake or Awake. I think it was something like that. No one knows about it. Nobody watched it. I think it was on NBC. I loved it, and it just ended after one season in maybe so, like 2010 or something.
My wife and I talked to him about a movie called Sweet November that he did with Keanu Reeves and Charlize Theron. He played like a drag queen, and he was spectacular in it. And he remembered. He gave us so many. Great stories about it. He was the nicest guy ever.
So he was playing a drag meeting. Queen, but he is not himself a drag queen. So did, cultural appropriation, did you?
I called him
face?
Out on that. Oh, yeah.
Good.
I told him, great. You're disgusting, man. That's
fabulous.
No, back then you could do anything, I think.
Sure. Why not?
Yeah, 20 years ago.
So also in July, we did this live show at the Comedy Cellar, which was heaps of fun. And
yeah, thanks, you got to do your stand-up.
To know, well, I just said it. I just said one bad taste, funny thing about the fact that there'd just been a shooting in New York. I wouldn't call it stand up exactly.
It was an
introduction.
Yeah.
An introduction. So thanks to Noam Dorman as well for giving us that space. And he's a great guy. He's a mensch. He had me on his show live from the table at the Comedy Cellar to try to grill me about my anti-Israel, they're not anti-Israel views, what people call anti-Israel views, my criticism of the conduct of the Netanyahu government. Also, yes, so Washington, D.C., incredibly hot. We sat outside great. With Tyler Cowen again, and Tyler was great. Lots of great stuff there. August, we released all of the tour. My dad had just died, so I released the eulogy of his funeral.
Powerful.
In August as well. And I had the founders of Substack on the show that month as well to talk about, because they just had this, you know,
they were pushing
live valuation or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Hamish and, is it Hamish McKenzie?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And Chris Fest.
I thought that was great.
And
they
then
didn't,
September,
they didn't talk about my community managing though, which I was.
No, they didn't. They
about,
talked about that off the air. Off the air, they were talking about how amazing Evan Pavanka is,
and
how tireless.
I told them. You know, they keep offering me all this money and, you know, prestige to become an official Substack thing. But I got, you know, I got Little League to drive and coach.
Exactly.
And
you got things to do.
Ain't nobody got time for that.
That's right. Then in September, I really liked the conversation with Waleed Ali as well.
Oh.
The Muslim Australian journalist and academic and television host, which was about liberalism. And I think it's even more relevant this week well, over the past few weeks, because as everyone in Australia is kind of picking up the pieces and thinking about social cohesion, Waleed, as a practicing serious Muslim, but also a really smart, thoughtful guy, is less optimistic about liberalism than I was. And I was sort of the Pollyanna in the conversation saying, like, you know, liberalism can work. And he was like, I'm not sure that, I'm not sure that it can. And so now for my community to be the one that has been assassinated and executed by a deranged member, I mean, I don't want to say of his community, because he would absolutely, I mean, he's been texting me his sympathies, and obviously would have nothing to do with it. But from the perspective of group identitarianism, his concerns have proven more right than I had wanted them to be.
Yeah. And I'm fast forwarding chronologically, but the woman who's like an expat living in France, who writes all the collapse literature.
Sarah.
Sarah. I thought that was
Sarah
great
Wilson.
Too. I mean, that's that topic. I was preparing a class that I'm going to teach called The End of Democracy in America, focused on Tocqueville's analysis of American democracy.
And I want to take that.
Catchy title too, right? That'll get them in that door. I joked that we would just read the last chapter of Democracy in America every day for the entire semester. Deep textual analysis of just the end of Democracy in America. But I think that's going to be, unfortunately, a very relevant topic in the near future. Yeah. And I, unfortunately, if you believe Tocqueville, his sort of warnings about American democracy 200 years ago are all coming true. And not that America represents all of liberalism and democracy, but it's certainly, is kind of the canary in the coal mine, I think. And there's real cause for
concern.
If
it's any consolation, I'm more optimistic about America than I think a lot of Americans are at the moment, because the problems of holding together societies in Europe, which I thought Australia was immune from, but maybe not, we'll see. The problems in Europe are really demographic ones, and ones that run into deep questions of social cohesion and cultural unity. And when you couple that with sluggish economic growth in Europe, it's and the kind of migration pressures, it is hard to know how to back out of that. Whereas in the case of the United States, you've got an underlying economy that's strong, that's innovative. You've got populations who, at least along ethnic lines, are living together very well, even if politically there's a lot of partisanship. And so the solution does seem somewhat more simple, like just don't become authoritarian.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like elect people who aren't dictatorial shitheads and things might be okay.
I think I'm kind of approaching it from a different angle with the relationship to capitalism that, you know, Tocqueville, well, I won't, you'll have to take the class, Josh, but the idea that, you know, we're obsessed with money and making money and innovating, all the things that you said. But what balanced that out for Tocqueville was civic associations, you know, our ability to interact. Like, we can fight it out in the boardroom, but we still all go over to our neighbor's house for Sunday dinner or whatever, you know, and like a chemical reaction, when you start pulling a few carbon atoms away and whatever, things can get pretty reactive. And I'm worried about the lack of just, you know, social interaction, that we don't hang out with neighbors, we don't congregate and talk, and democracy needs some level of understanding what other people are going through. And I think we're losing a lot of the institutional framework for exploring common problems and, you know, fundamental things like that. I'm more worried about that than I am the authoritarian. Because you're right. An election can switch that whole thing, hopefully. But I think a deeper problem is just our inability to talk to each other, you know, which is why I'm frankly so passionate about, you know, what you do. I think we need more.
Yeah.
But there, I went. I went at least 20 minutes without complimenting you. Yeah,
that was fine, and it was a modest compliment as well. I think there are big questions around artificial intelligence, social media algorithms, the thought bubbles and echo chambers, and like demographic self-sorting of people just into, you know, their own bubbles that are massively problematic and complicated, but they exist everywhere and we're all going to have to figure those out. Maybe they're more pronounced in America. September, Charlie Kirk also happened in September. So there was that whole thing.
The news and happens fast, huh?
It does, doesn't it? Right?
Holy cow.
And then October, there was some interesting conversations. I got a lot of interesting feedback about the conversation with Robert Wintermute, who's the gay lawyer who is speaking out about the conflict between transgender rights and women's rights and gay rights. He was originally one of the founders of the transgender rights sort of charter, and has since turned around and feels like the movement has lost its way.
Yeah, Andrew Sullivan obviously is. That's been a very prominent theme in his writing and conversations lately, too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there was another good chat about Israel in October, which was with the Israeli journalist Yaakov Katz, who was in Jerusalem. And he and I sort of argued. That was called Gaza 3.0, if people want to go back and listen to that. And Will Anderson was also in October, which was great. And then in November, there were a couple of good ones. There was the Tucker Carlson editorial that you mentioned. There was this climate change solution with this scientist,
Kiko algae?
Toro, the algae.
Oh, my gosh.
Wasn't that so cool?
So cool. He was in my top five.
Absolutely fascinating.
I think as the community manager, your homework, everyone's homework, is to go back, and I think it's up now on the page, to go back and listen to that, because it was a live that you did, and I think a few people caught it.
Oh, yeah, we released it on the pod as on the 3rd of November, and it's called The Climate Change Solution So Crazy It Just Might Work.
Whoa!
With Kiko Toro. And he's got this nonprofit that's looking into, I won't spoil it, but basically a way that we could reduce, the way that we could absorb carbon naturally and head off the worst consequences of climate change, potentially by enlisting the assistance of some South Pacific countries.
Yeah.
And it
geothermal vents.
Algae.
Let's go. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do it. November was also Prime Minister Tony Abbott talking about refugees and the fate of Western civilization. And then in December, another one that Jono, the producer, really liked was this one about veganism and animal cruelty with Aidan Alexander, who has this nonprofit.
Yeah, that was great.
Why are you laughing?
For people who haven't sat down with Josh to talk, it's not the easiest thing to do. I mean, you got to come ready. Like, and strong. And you kept bringing up like animal cruelty stuff. And he was
all right.
Like, I don't want to talk about that, Josh. Yeah, I don't want to talk about that. I love watching that.
I just wanted to remind people, you know, what the practices are in factory farms.
Yeah.
Yeah. That people might object to, but that we persist in doing nonetheless.
He's like,
I want to talk about positive. I want to talk about positive solutions. I'm like, we'll get to the solutions. Talk about the bloodshed first.
We have to feel terrible about it first.
But his argument is that, you know, you should not, that it's a mistake for animal rights activists to frame this as being like, you should go vegan or vegetarian, otherwise you're an immoral person.
Right.
That actually there are very simple things that you can do and clear charities that you can donate to who are doing real lobbying and making real efforts to have you just had a stroke?
No, sorry. I was looking for Joel. I have Joel Salatin's book.
Oh, okay. For people not watching the video, Evan just looked over to the right hand side.
But yes,
had the same kind of look on your face that Joe Biden did during the debate.
Or his entire presidency.
Yeah, that's right, for the past 20 years. And so the argument is that there are things that we can do that would make factory farming much less cruel whilst we continue to eat meat, if we so wish.
Yeah. And piecemeal stuff, like it, we don't all need to go to the extreme to make real change. That's the you know, there's such so much low-hanging fruit that's protected by corporate interests that with a few pen strokes could be fixed. You know, the ag gag bills and things like that, that would make a world of difference. I mean, you caught a lot, the conversation with Sam when you guys talked about whether it's, you know, it's one drop in the bucket if I don't eat meat or whatever, got a lot of traction in the comments. And, you know, that idea that some small institutional changes could make a big, big difference. And we don't need moonshots. We don't need everybody to be vegan to fix this problem. It's a good reminder.
Yeah, exactly. So people's homework is you can listen to that one, the Tony Abbott, the climate change solution, so crazy it just might work. Pretty much the whole world tour, Sam Harris, Tyler Cowen, Nick Cave, Rich Roll. Nick Cave. You know who I didn't mention who was one of my favorites of the year? It was Camille Foster.
Oh, well, Camille, I mean, all the fifth column, fourth column?
Yeah, the fifth column.
Third column, fifth column.
I mean, Matt Welch was also on the show and fabulous. Michael Moynihan's always great, but he hasn't been on the show this year. But Camille was just in a very, I think because my dad had just died and we had just gotten lunch and I was sort of getting a bit teary about that. And then we went into the recording. He was like very gentle and almost spiritual and kind of,
I agree.
He's an extremely humane and mature person, Camille.
That was a real, because I'm a fan of theirs and I try to listen when I can, but hearing that one-on-one, that was really rewarding for me too. So
people should listen to that. Then there's Josh versus the anti-gay parenting activist, Katie Faust. There's the Palestinian delusion with Einat. And from the other perspective, why Gaza is genocide. There's also Gaza 3.0. Those would be your triumvirate of Israel-Gaza conversations.
Well, and
That's
after you go back and listen to all the lives that I've done with you.
Of course. Evan's episodes are the most important. Then there's the reimagining schooling with Parsi Sahlberg. Jono also really liked the former Australian Foreign Minister, Bob Carr. Which is a good one for Australians, but maybe not for foreigners. And, John McWhorter as well. I didn't mention
Spectacular.
John. He's so good.
I could talk
to John once a month, once a week, once a day.
Yeah. On language and linguistics. I mean, he is, you know, I think you guys covered some interesting terrain in that conversation, if I remember, including a lot of, potentially hot button stuff. So it was good.
And also just funny language stuff as well. We've got Steven Pinker coming up. I'm not sure if he will have dropped already by the time this goes out on the podcast.
Oh, but, I thought you meant dropped out he's watching this.
No, and he's like, I'm not doing a show which McWhorter has done. But yes, that'll be one to look out for in either coming weeks or previous weeks, if you're listening to this after the fact and not watching it live.
Awesome.
Evan, thank you for your tireless work this year. I can't believe you put in, I mean, I was looking at your time log and it seems like you've worked 365 days in 2025.
I wouldn't do it for anyone other than you, Josh. You know that.
Amazing.
I'll be better. I need to hear from our community.
You want the people. You want the people to decide.
Yeah.
So if people have suggestions, if there are things that you like, if there are types of episodes that you really enjoy or ones that you didn't like so much, then you can chat in the, either comment on a note on Substack or you can comment under the actual video itself, or you can send an email to uncomfyconvos@gmail.com. And Evan, at some point in 2027, will then review them.
No, 2026. I will be better. Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready to step up. I'm not a New Year's resolutionist
to go
guy, but we're renovating our house. We're moving out to our mountain. I'm going to be even more mountain man for the next
year.
Not
possible.
Oh, possible, Josh. Challenge accepted.
You have where's your mountain?
It's about 20 minutes outside of town. We have 80 acres. I'll shoot the next live from there. I'll give you the view of the Blue Ridge. It's spectacular. Yeah, it's really a special place.
Remind people what state this is.
Oh, I live in Charlottesville, Virginia. So nestled
the Virginia
up,
mountains.
Nestled up against the Blue Ridge. I mean, I'll continue to send invitations weekly as I've been doing, and you can continue to ignore them.
Someday my kids and I will be strolling, we'll be hiking the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Yeah, we can sit on the Adirondack chairs out back, just in single style, and spray sunscreen into each other's eyes. It'll be romantic.
It's a date. Thank you, Evan. Thank you to all of the listeners and viewers, and thank you to all of the people who've been on the show this year. Here's to a fabulous 2026. I'll see you on the other side, buddy.
Let's go. All right. See you, bud.